Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome to the Salieri Report a wonderful CPA who's joined us before, Patty Kemmerer, who is a principal and founder of Kemmerer Schooley Smith CPAs in Centerville, Virginia. She is a very experienced with both small business and not-for-profits and individuals. Her breadth is extraordinary. I know because I've worked with her for many years, since the mid-90s. I lost her at one point, but was able to get her back when she started her own firm. And so she joined us last year on the Salieri Report, and I can think of no one better to cover the issues of tax planning at the end of the year. How do we, one of my favorite news sites says, all the news, well, there's still time to do something about it. And being the first week in December, this is a good time to look back at 2014 and say, what do I need to do before the year closes to make sure I've got my taxes in order? And then what do I need to think about and plan for in 2015? So I asked Patty to join us again this year, and I'm delighted that she could. Patty, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me back again.
Well, you know, I told you one of the questions I'm going to ask you when we get later on in the conversation is how do I find a good CPA? I get asked that all the time because the first thing somebody says is, are you happy with your CPA? I said, yeah, I have a fabulous CPA. And then the next question is always, how do I find someone like them? And all I can tell you is, it was very serendipity how I met you, but I have to say I lucked out. So let's just dive in. We have a long list of things to talk about, but before 12/31, why don't you walk us through some of the most important things we need to think about? And let's just start with retirement plans, because that's one I get a lot of questions with at the end of the year. Walk us through what you would focus us on for our retirement plans.
Sure. I think one of the best things that you can do if you are an employee is to try and maximize your retirement plan contributions. If they're pre-tax, every dollar that you put into that retirement plan is not taxed on line one of your W-2 form. So that definitely saves you tax dollars today and puts money away for you for the future. You can put in, if you're a single person through the end of 2014, if you're under 50, you can put in $17,500. And for a person who's 50 or over, $23,000 is the maximum contribution for 2014. And all those dollars are pre-tax. They sit there and they earn money for you until you're ready to retire. And the theory is that when you retire, you'll be in a lower tax bracket. Excuse me. And those dollars, if they are pre-tax, those dollars will be taxed when you pull them out. But the theory is that you'll be in a lower tax bracket at that time, so you'll pay a lower amount of tax on them today than if you take them out in your paycheck. You'll pay lower tax later than you will today if you take them out as payroll in your paycheck. So that's a great way to plan for the future and save some tax dollars today. Another
Patty, go ahead. You go ahead. Because I was going to just skip to the Roth. That's for a regular IRA. Is the amount the same for a Roth?
Right. It's an employer retirement plan.
Okay.
That I'm talking about, basically a 401k plan that's not a Roth. And so that's one thing that you can possibly do before the end of the year, particularly if you're getting a bonus. You could possibly maximize your 401k. And for self-employed, they have until the due date of their tax return to fund a solo 401k or a SEP, which is a self-employed pension plan. The 401k plan has to be established by December 31st of this year. But you have until the due date of the tax return plus extensions to fund it. The SEP can be established up until the due date of the tax return plus extensions. So there's still time to plan if you're a self-employed person. Now, contributions to a Roth 401k and a Roth IRA are not pre-tax dollars. Those are post-tax dollars that you put aside. That money continues to grow for you until you reach retirement age, which is 59 and a half. And as long as you've had a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k plan in established for at least 5 years, once you reach that retirement age, you can take those monies out tax-free, including the earnings on the contributions. So that's a really great way to plan for your retirement in the future. The other great thing about a Roth is that you don't have a minimum required distribution that you have to take, unlike a regular 401k or a regular traditional IRA. You never have to take the money out should you choose not to do so. And you can also continue to put money aside in those Roths as long as you have earned income, even after age 70 and a half, unlike a regular traditional IRA plan.
Okay, and what about qualified withdrawals from retirement plans?
Right. Qualified withdrawals occur once you're at 59 and a half and you've had the plan open for at least 5 years for a Roth, or if it's a traditional or a regular 401k, you don't have to have it established for at least 5 years to avoid penalty. So those are qualified distributions. But in addition, there are some other qualified withdrawals that you can make that are not going to be subject to penalty. You can withdraw up to $10,000 for a first-time home purchase out of your retirement plan if you're not 59 and a half yet, and not have to pay a penalty on that money. If it's from a traditional, you will pay the tax. If it's from a Roth, you will not have any tax consequence on that. You can also withdraw for post-secondary education expenses. Withdrawals due to death and disability are also not subject to penalty. And withdrawals for unreimbursed medical expenses that exceed 10% of your adjusted gross income if you were born after in 1950 or later. For those born before 1949, that threshold is 7.5%. So if you do have some major medical issue that you need to withdraw from your plan to pay the expenses, you can do that without penalty once it exceeds the threshold of 10% of your adjusted gross.
Patty, the withdrawal for post-secondary, is it for your own or can you do it for a child or relative?
The post-secondary education expenses, if it's a dependent of yours, I would not have any penalty for that. I'm not sure about others that are not dependents, but I can check on that and get back to you with an answer.
No worry. If it comes up, I'll let you know. Let's skip to 529 plans because I keep finding I'm getting more, as people are worried about paying for college education for kids and grandkids, I'm getting more and more questions about 529 plans. So why don't we skip to that?
Okay. It's not too late to contribute for 2014. Contributions to a 529 plan are not deductible for federal income taxes, but most states allow a deduction for funding of a 529 plan. Now, once the beneficiary starts withdrawing for their higher education expenses down the road, it's not taxable to the beneficiary as long as it doesn't exceed their qualified education expenses. Also, you can roll over these 529 plans from one to another as long as you do so within 60 days of the distribution without any penalty. So they can be moved.
I was amazed. I was very concerned that people putting money in 529s would not be able to pay for foreign education. And increasingly, you know, kids, it's a tremendous benefit to spend time abroad or get educated abroad. And I went to the Department of Education website last month to look at what foreign schools, you know, would accept or were eligible for 529 funding, and I was astonished. It's hundreds and hundreds. So the whole 529 program just keeps getting more and more flexible. It's incredible. Okay, capital gains. This is the one as an investment advisor everybody always thinks of at the end of the year. You know, taking losses and gains on the portfolio before year end or waiting until next year. So walk us through capital gains and losses.
Right. Yes, capital gains, you know, everybody is concerned about towards the end of the year. And one of the things I always mention to folks, and of course I'm not an investment advisor, but if you have capital gains in your portfolio, talk to your investment advisor about perhaps harvesting some losses on maybe some underperforming investments that can offset some of those gains. That's always one approach that you can take. Take a look at and evaluate your portfolio and see if you have anything there that you can use to shelter those gains. The capital gains rates for 2014 range from 0% for the lower income taxpayers up to 20% for the highest income taxpayers. And those rates are directly related to what tax bracket that you're in. Most taxpayers fall into the 15% or below capital gains rate. Now, the other thing that you have to be concerned about with capital gains and other investment income is this new net investment income tax of 3.8% on investment income for taxpayers with a modified adjusted gross income of $200,000 or more for a single taxpayer and $250,000 for a married filing joint or surviving spouse, and that drops to $125,000 for a married filing separate tax return. And net investment income generally includes interest, dividends, capital gains, rent and royalty income, and non-qualified annuities. So it's not just capital gains, but other investment income as well can be subject to this 3.8% if your modified adjusted gross income is over those thresholds that I just mentioned.
Right, it's quite a hit. One of the things I wanted to ask you, Patty, is we have many subscribers in our network who have both securities, capital gains, stocks and bonds, but also invest in all sorts of different tangibles, which have a 28% rate.
Right.
And the question is, if you have a loss on a tangible or a gain in a tangible, can it be netted with your losses or gains on the securities investments? Are they nettable?
I believe that they are. I will double check that and let you know for sure.
Okay.
But I believe that they are. You know, we let our computers do all that thinking for us, so sometimes we forget the details. So
well,
I will double check that and get back to you.
All my client CPAs come back and say yes, it is. So I, you know, but I always like to confirm.
Yeah, my gut reaction is it's definitely nettable, but I will double check it and confirm it.
Okay. Okay, I'll post. Estimated tax payments. This is always the painful one.
It is. You know, estimated tax payments are supposed to be paid throughout the year. A lot of times people don't realize that they need to make them until they get close to the end of the year and they find out they're getting a huge capital gain distribution from an investment, for example.
Right.
Or I have a client that called me yesterday who found out he's getting a huge royalty that he wasn't expecting. So now he has to increase his estimated tax payments. The fourth quarter payment is actually due on January 15th of 2015. The issue becomes if you haven't paid the first three quarters, the IRS assumes that you earn equally, evenly throughout the year, which, of course, we all know doesn't actually happen. So if you find that you're in this situation, you can make your fourth quarter payment. And when it comes to tax time, you can file a Form 2210 showing how you earned your income throughout the year and the related deductible expenses that you have on your tax return. This can inform the IRS, hey, I didn't earn this equally throughout the year. I got this big windfall in the fourth quarter, and this is why I didn't pay tax on the first three quarters. And this will reduce penalties and interest on your late payment of the tax that you owe for the year.
Now, don't you need to make the state estimated by the end of December if you want to get the deduction on your federal?
That is correct. If you want to get the deduction on your federal, you do need, even though it's not due until January 15th, if you make it by December 31st, you'll be able to deduct it on your Schedule A for 2014. If you wait until January to make the payment, you won't be able to deduct it until the following year.
And when I worked in Wall Street, I was married to a law firm partner, and we were adamant about rushing to make that December payment because it was so big in New York State. Taxes were some of the worst. Okay, let's turn to gifting. Gifting is very important in our networks. Walk us through what the gifting numbers are for this year, because it's going up a little bit.
Well, if you you can gift to another person up to $14,000 without having to file a gift tax return. What a lot of people don't understand about gifting is that the gift tax is imposed on the person who gives the gift, not the person who receives the gift. Most people think it's the person who gets the gift that has to pay gift tax, and that is not the case. So a married couple, for example, could each gift $14,000 to a child or a parent, for example, and that would be a total gift of $28,000 that they could give without having to file a gift tax return. A gift tax return is a way to let the IRS know, hey, I've made lifetime gifts. That are, those gifts during your lifetime reduce the exclusion that your estate gets when you pass away. And it's usually not currently taxable, but it's an information return that has to be filed by April 15th, or it can be extended out until October 15th as well. But if you exceed the $14,000 of gifting to any one person, you do have to file the form and report the information to the IRS. So down the road, your estate will subtract your lifetime gifts from your estate exclusion.
And so the total amount that I can, the total amount I can donate or I can give to a child without paying a gift tax,
without having to file the form, is $14,000.
But if I file the form, how much can I gift without having to pay a tax?
Yeah, your lifetime gift can be as much as $5,340,000 as of 2014.
Okay.
So most people are not going to be in a situation where they have to actually pay tax on the gifts that they give, but they do have to report them. That's the important thing to note. The reporting is the key. Generally, you won't end up paying a tax during your lifetime.
Right.
So, and the other thing is, we talked about the 529 plans.
Mm-hmm.
You can gift, for example, in 2014, you could give a gift to a 529 plan for an individual of up to $70,000. This is a special rule for 529 plans. You could gift up to $70,000 this year, and you would be able to spread that gift over 5 years, so it would be $14,000 a year, I think, for 5 years. But you will have to file the gift tax form to show that you have elected to spread that gift over a five-year period. Even though it does, because it's $14,000, it does not reduce that lifetime exclusion. But
right.
It does have to be reported because you're electing to make the full amount of the five-year gift in 1 year, if that makes sense.
Right. Now, there's unlimited exclusion for paying educational and healthcare costs, right?
That's correct. So,
but
you have to make those payments directly to the educational institution or the medical provider in order for those gifts to be excluded. You can't give the money to the child to then pay for the education. You have to pay directly to the educational institution in order.
But this, the exclusion is not just for kids. In other words, I can tax-free pay the tuition for anybody.
That's correct.
Right. Okay.
That's correct. But you have to pay it directly to the institution, not give it to the person to pay it.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's turn to our favorite, the Affordable Care Act.
Yay.
And we have a question here, but dive right in. I know this one has me tearing my hair out, and I barely look at it, and I can't imagine what it's like if you're a CPA dealing with this. So anyway, so let's dive in and talk about the shared responsibility excise tax.
Correct. That is what that is basically a penalty tax for not participating in a qualified health plan. So, as you know, the Affordable Care Act is requiring everyone to get health insurance unless they're specifically exempt. Now, there are exempt individuals include non-resident aliens and those who are not lawfully present in the United States, individuals who have a religious conscientious exemption certificate from a state. They actually have to go to the state and apply for that. Individual who would incur a hardship in order to purchase health care coverage, and they also must have a certificate stating that, you know, they have this hardship in order to be exempt. Individuals that have household incomes that are less than the gross income threshold for filing an income tax return, and individuals whose required contributions exceed 8% of their household income. So that's just a few of them. There are others, other exemptions as well, but those are the
let me just ask you, because one of the questions we got was how do I prove that it's more than 8% of my income? And we talked about it before we started, and you said, you know, that's a detail that you don't know off the top of your head, but it seems to me that if your tax return ought to be the, you know, the fundamental document that would prove it.
Right. That would definitely prove what your income is.
Is.
As far as proving that you can't find, qualified coverage for less than 8% of your income, get quotes.
Right.
Of course, you'd have to also find out what the exchanges are charging for health care. And I think that, you know, the exchange probably, that the amount that the exchange is quoting you is probably going to be one of the main items that can prove that it is more than 8% of your income.
Okay.
So your income can be proved easily enough with your tax return, but the issue is proving that the that you can't afford it. It's more than 8%.
Right.
So, I don't know. This is all brand new, so we'll see. I'm sure they'll come out with some sort of guidance on this, but it has not yet come out.
Well, for 2014, what are the penalties?
Okay, so the penalties are the lesser of the monthly national average premium for bronze level coverage offered for the applicable family size involved through an exchange. And in 2014, the bronze plan average premium was $204 for an individual and $1,020 for a family with five or more members. So that's one test. So it's either the lesser of that number or 1/12, this is very complicated, 1/12 of the greater of $95 per uninsured adult plus $47.50 per uninsured person under the age of 18, not to exceed $285, or 1% of the taxpayer's household income for the current year in excess of the threshold amount of income required to file a Form 1040. So it's kind of a complicated calculation to figure out what the penalty is. Now, the penalty in 2014, basically, if you don't have insurance all year long, it's $95 per uninsured adult and $47.50 per uninsured person under 18, not to exceed $285.
Right.
Or 1% of the household income over that filing threshold number. So those are the numbers that you need to look at. So it's really not that bad for 2014. But in 2015, those numbers go up to $325 per uninsured adult and $162.50 per uninsured person under 18, or 2% of the taxpayer's household income. And in 2016, it more than doubles, $695 per uninsured adult plus $347.50 for uninsured person under 18, or 2.5% of the taxpayer's household income above the filing threshold. So it's not that bad in 2014, but it's going to get more expensive as things go along.
Right. So if you need to budget for it in 2015, if you're not going to get the insurance, what happens if you get insurance during the year, so it's partial,
right,
but partial is uninsured?
That's why they say it's 1/12 of those numbers. So each month, you take 1/12 of those numbers for each month that you're not insured, and that would be your penalty. So if you're uninsured for 6 months, it's 6/12 of those numbers would be your penalty.
Nightmare. Okay.
There's also a refundable premium tax credit that people who are buying the insurance can possibly get if they qualify for it. And it's a refundable credit. It's available in advance to be paid directly to the insurer to reduce the premiums, or the taxpayer can elect to pay the premiums in full and get the refund at the end of the year. And it's available to taxpayers with household income of at least 100%, but not more than 400% of the federal poverty line. And the federal poverty line for 2014 ranges from $11,670 for a single member family to $40,000 for an 8-member family. So let's just talk about a single member family just for a second. So 100% of that is $11,670, but 400% is $46,680. So if you're a single person and you make $46,000, you could qualify for this credit that can reduce the cost of your premiums, or you can get a refund at the end of the tax year through your 1040.
The biggest tax in the first year is going to be the time every family spends trying to figure this out.
Well, you know, they haven't made it easy for us, there's no doubt. So this is where finding a good tax preparer is probably in your best interest.
Right. Right. Well, because I'm the one who's always going to beat the drum on this, I think given the complexity of the tax system at this point, it's absolutely essential to have a professional help you prepare your taxes. You know, I know a lot of people who try and do it themselves, and I think it's fine to get it organized self, to do it yourself, to see what it's like, but then I think you walk it in, you know, to a professional and have them, you know, vet it and make sure it's fine. I just think we've reached a level of complexity that you, despite all the best intentions, and even with the good software, I think it's too easy to make a mistake, and I think it's too expensive to make a mistake. So I'll beat that drum. You don't have to. I just think you absolutely need a professional to review everything and do your taxes. Now, I have to ask you about crowdfunding, because year long, as I've been watching, you know, there are many different kinds of crowdfunding. We're not going to touch on all of them here, but if I'm watching the crowdfunding, I'm thinking, how does this work from a tax standpoint, and how does this work from a federal tax point and a state, you know, because you're crossing all sorts of both country and state jurisdictions, and I'm thinking, how is this going to work? And I can't find any direction. So I asked you if we could talk about crowdfunding. Now, when I say crowdfunding, put aside the securities issues, because that's still in most places on the back burner for now. Let's just talk about the donations. It's the gifting, the crowdfunding websites where you give money and you, a lot of times you, sometimes you get nothing, sometimes you get the product. So let's just talk about what do we know about the tax implications of crowdfunding?
Well, one thing that we know for sure is that crowdfunding is not a deductible donation unless it is paid to a charitable organization. That we definitely know. So it's not deductible if it's not paid directly to a tax-exempt charitable organization. So if you're funding a person, you're not going to get a deduction. Now, on the flip side of that is, what is the implication for the person receiving the funding? And that's still a gray area. The question is it a gift or is it taxable income? And there really is no clear answer to that right now. The IRS probably will have a test case in the next year or two where they will challenge this. I'm sure they're going to want to make it taxable income, but I think the end result is probably going to be, it depends on the facts and circumstances in each case.
Right. So if there's
go ahead.
If there's a, you know, say I crowdfund the creation of a product, and let's say my donation is $100 and say the retail sales of the product would be, say, $40. Mm-hmm. So $40 is a sale and $60 is a gift. Is my guess as to what they're going to try and do.
That may very well be the case. And there just really isn't any clear answer on that right now.
Right.
But I'm, you know, as it becomes more and more popular, especially those fund me sites in particular,
right.
You know, fund me for this and fund me for that. This is definitely going to become an issue that's going to rise to the forefront in the next couple of years, and I'm sure we'll start getting some answers.
Well, it's interesting if a way is done so that you write the check to the educational institution. Or, in fact, you set up a website in cooperation with the educational institution and the money goes directly to them, couldn't it then be deemed a gift?
I would think that it definitely could be deemed a gift.
Right.
And, you know, under the gift tax rules. But it would have to be to the institution and not to the person who's trying to get their education paid for.
Right. So if you crowdfund a website, if you want to crowdfund your education, you need to remember this. It makes a big difference. Okay. So that's 2014. Let's talk about 2015. What's coming?
Yeah, there's really not a whole lot out there right now, but for people who have small businesses, and when I say a small business, it can be, you know, several hundred employees, but employers with 50 or more full-time employees or full-time equivalent employees who fail to offer their employees an opportunity to enroll in an eligible employer-sponsored health plan, and at least one of their full-time employees receives a premium tax credit, they'll have to pay an excise tax starting in 2015. And it's expected that this tax is going to be $170 per month per employee.
Ouch.
So that's a big ouch. And unfortunately, this is why a lot of these restaurants and other employers have cut their full-time employees back to part-time.
Right.
So that they don't have to offer this and get penalized for not offering it, which is really unfortunate for the employees who would otherwise prefer to work full time. So that's one of the reasons you see this kind of thing that's happening. Now, on another matter, yes, go ahead.
I just saw an announcement that Amazon had added 15,000 robots to their warehouses,
uh-huh.
and were looking to hire 80,000 part-time workers for Christmas. And I said, oh, great, the robots get the full-time employment and the
right.
And the humans get the part-time employment, and it wouldn't surprise me if this is one of the reasons why.
Absolutely. This is definitely an issue for employers that they've focused on. And, it's just really unfortunate that a lot of people are seeking full-time employment and can't find it, and this is one of the reasons why.
Right.
But on another matter, for those who work from home, the IRS has come out with a ruling that has loosened the exclusive rule used for deducting a home office. The home office expense deduction is for people who have an office at home that's used regularly and exclusively for business. They can deduct a portion of their rent or their mortgage interest, real estate taxes, utilities, et cetera.
And this is really good news.
This is good news. It is a fairly limited loosening, however. The circumstances have to be such that the de minimis personal use is unavoidable. For example, someone at this particular case, the person had a studio apartment in New York City, and it was unavoidable that they could not help but walk through their workspace to get to other parts of the apartment. So the IRS or the court came out and said, this is reasonable, de minimis use, it can't be avoided, so we're going to go ahead and allow the deduction. So this is good news for people who work from home in small spaces.
Now, I have to just bring up, this is one that has taken an extraordinary investment of my time personally this year. I have to bring up the dynamic nature of online sales tax. I'm in a state that doesn't have an income tax, but we have a very big sales tax. And
right.
The state government, which I argue is very good, depends on that sales tax. So it's important, and it's shared with the county, so it can get complicated. But this year, because of the dynamic nature of the, states trying to collect taxes on online sales, we sat down at Solari and wrote a document that went through all the different products and services and individual situations and who's purchasing stuff online and why, or selling stuff online and why. We're moving online on both sides of the ledger, and what the state taxes were in Tennessee as well as Michigan, where we have a payroll. And Patty, it took it took three of us, I don't know, maybe 20 hours each, and then we found an expert in Tennessee state taxes and had them review and read it. And when it was all done, what I have to tell you is there can't possibly be one small business in Tennessee which is in impeccable compliance, because it took us, in combination with the experts, maybe 50 hours to really figure out what the taxes were we owed and how to calculate them. And it was complicated to the extreme. And the reality is now, if we buy something online and they don't charge sales tax, we have to calculate it. And, so if I buy a $3 book from somebody in Washington, then I've got to calculate a tax and send it into Tennessee. So the one thing I would say to everyone is, looking ahead to 2015, you need to take time to learn what the evolution of sales and other taxes related to online is for your personal life and business, and make sure that you've made an effort to understand and are in compliance. Because I just think this, this area is going to get more and more dynamic and more complicated. And if you're particularly if you're in a state where sales tax is important, you just don't want to get out of compliance and stay out of compliance. So that's one I don't know if you've run into that yet, but we've been tearing our hair out.
Right. Most states have a youth tax, is what it's called. And basically what happens is if I buy, I live in Virginia, and if I buy something from Atlanta or from Georgia and I have it sent to my house, they don't have to charge Virginia sales tax, but I am required to file a form at the end of the year saying the purchases that I made of tangible property. Now, this is the key. It's tangible property that that I owe sales tax on to the state of Virginia because I wasn't charged sales tax when I purchased it online. And most states do have a similar type of tax. And there's a difference between purchasing services online and purchasing tangible property. So tangible property is subject to the tax. Services are not, and every state has a different way of determining what they consider to be tangible and non-tangible. So definitely you want to consult a tax advisor to determine your requirement to pay the use tax to your state.
One of the reasons I bring it up is many of these taxes have always existed, but it hasn't been a significant, you know, sort of portion of the revenue base, and states haven't taken enforcement seriously. But now, as online sales grow dramatically, I think they're starting to take it very seriously, and they have to take it very seriously. So
that's
correct.
There's a movement afoot also among brick-and-mortar businesses to ensure that sales tax is always charged on online sales as well, because brick-and-mortars feel that the fact that sales tax is not often charged on an online purchase is hurting their business.
They're right.
Because someone can go online and purchase the same item without having to pay the sales tax. So
right.
There is a movement afoot as well to try to get some law passed in Congress to have online retailers collect these sales taxes.
Okay, Republican majority in the National Congress. Do you think it's going to make any difference to taxes looking forward?
You know, it's really hard to say. Certainly, there may be more potential to get something done, but the reality is that the tax law is so complex, and the special interests are so great that it's going to be very difficult to get the tax rule simplified sufficiently in any one year. If it happens, it's going to take a great deal of time. And it's, you know, the idea of, tax rules for revamping the tax rules for corporations is even more remote, I would say. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Right. I will say this, every year we talk about this, or every year we go through tax issues at the end of the year and tax planning, every year it gets more complicated. And I know if you look at the polls, there's tremendous political support for simplification, but achieving it is, as I agree with you, it's yet again another thing. Well, let's turn to the question I always get, which is, how do I find a good bookkeeper? How do I find a good CPA? And on the bookkeeper issue, there's also a how do I find, you know, what kind of software, all sorts of other organizational issues. So walk us through, I know I keep asking this question every year, but help people understand how to find the kind of services they need to make sure that their financial accounting and planning is in good order.
Right. Well, one of the best ways to find a good bookkeeper or CPA is to ask someone you know and trust who has someone that they know and trust and have been very happy with. Word of mouth referrals are usually the best types of referrals to find the quality person that you're looking for. If you don't know anybody that has a CPA or a bookkeeper, particularly CPA, you can usually go to your state board of CPAs, and they can refer you to several CPAs that you can then go interview and find out who's the best fit for you. And often,
now, when you interview, can you ask them for references?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I would recommend that you do so.
Right.
Definitely. And talk to the people that have been working with them. and see what their thoughts are. And right, also, if you're looking for a good bookkeeper, a lot of CPAs know good bookkeepers. We really like to have bookkeepers that we feel understand bookkeeping. There are a lot of bookkeepers out there that charge low prices and don't really understand accounting the way that they should.
Right.
Which makes a lot more work for us at the end of the year when we're trying to prepare tax returns, for particularly for businesses. So
right.
Do try to get a referral to a good bookkeeper that's fairly well established, and also ask for references for that person as well.
One of the things I like to do is I like to have redundancy. So if I have a good bookkeeper, if I have a good CPA, there's a lot of checks and balances. And, you know, I always find no matter how great somebody is, they miss something. And it's by having several people go through everything, look at it, share it, that we, you know, we make sure things are impeccable.
Yeah,
and,
I agree.
One of the things I keep beating the drums, there are two things I always say, you know, keep great records, pay for great help on this stuff, and never, ever, ever, ever intentionally violate any of the rules or regulations, because it's just not worth it. And, you know, and I'm amazed at how many times somebody says, oh, well, you know, I can sell those coins because, you know, I bought them with cash. It's like, I don't have to pay taxes. I said, no, no, no,
no,
no.
No, I've had people come to me and say, well, you know, I have a rental property, but I don't want to report the rent. And at that point, I said, well, then you just told me you have rental income, so I can't prepare your return. You know, I mean, it happens all the time. So, yeah, definitely you don't want to go there.
Right.
You know, make
right.
sure
so,
that you're following the rules, no matter how distasteful they may be.
Our theme for 2015 is Live a Free and Inspired Life. And what I've found is great bookkeeping, great tax preparation, having a CPA, and being impeccable about all this stuff is the basis of freedom.
Agreed.
Doesn't feel free to do all that work, but once you've got it all done and you know, when the tax guy shows up at the door, you're like, hey, would you like some coffee? It's good to see you. Not a problem.
Absolutely.
Okay, Patty, any other thoughts before we close?
No, I think that's all I have for you today. But, you know, I'd be happy to take any questions from your subscribers. If they want to forward questions, you know, feel free to forward them on to me, and I'll be happy to try to answer them. And I'll get back to you on the points that we discussed that I didn't have a firm answer on. And,
well, I very much appreciate your doing this. I think when we do this, and we'll send out the update this week, you know, it focuses everybody on, right, it's the beginning of December. I have to think about, you know, I have to think about what do I need to do before the end of the year. So it's always that update always inspires everyone to, oh, yeah, before I go shopping, maybe I ought to take care of this. So I thank you for helping us get organized, get focused, and I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season, Patty.
Thank you. I hope you all and your subscribers do as well.
Good day. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.